Well, good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, November the 3rd, 2013, and it is 10:01, and we are beginning our Sunday school on time, which is my hope, my aspiration. I'm really excited to be here today. We are on our 12th episode of Plutarch's Lives. Now, as you will recall, Plutarch was a Greek. He was born in Chironi in Boeotia in Greece. And Chironi is a city which is northwest of Athens by a couple of hundred miles. Plutarch was born in 45 AD and he died in 120 AD. He is mostly famous for the 46 parallel biographies that he wrote. He is also famous for a series of essays, his moral essays, all of which are worthy of study, and maybe one day we will come back and study some of his essays. I'm probably through after today with the study of the 12 lives which we have just studied. And I want to remind you of those 12 lives so that we can put into broader context what we're doing. We did the parallel lives of Theseus and Romulus, who are respectively the mythological founders of Greece and of Rome. We did the lives of Lycurgus and Numa, who are quasi-mythological lawgivers for Rome and for Greece. We have studied Coriolanus and Alcibiades, who are two great generals from Rome and Greece respectively, both of whom betrayed their countries in very dramatic fashion. We have studied Demosthenes and Cicero, who were statesmen, orators, great and famous statesmen and orators of Greece and Rome respectively. We have done Pericles and Fabius Maximus. Pericles is the great leader from the golden age of Greece, and Fabius Maximus was somebody who was unknown to me before we did the parallel life, but Fabius Maximus was a great Roman general who was responsible for delaying tactics against Hannibal. And his name, Fabius Maximus, came to be used by the Fabian Society at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, because they were great socialists, and their tactic was to use delay and delay and delay and long-range planning in order to accomplish their goal of worldwide socialism. So Fabius Maximus has very strong connections to our current period. And then finally, we've done Alexander already, and today we are going to look at the life of Julius Caesar. And these two are perhaps the two greatest generals of all time, I would say. As you'll recall from talking about Plutarch in the past, he was very famous in his own time. He was a wealthy aristocrat. He traveled to Rome and he gave lectures there. He learned philosophy and rhetoric at Athens. He became a priest of the Apollo at Delphi. He was given honors by the Roman emperors during the time of his life. He became the procurator, which is a governor of Greece. He was a very, very famous man. You will know from our previous conversations that some of the lives that Plutarch wrote about, for example, Julius Caesar, the one we're doing today, Coriolanus, and then Antony and Cleopatra, all were the basis of Shakespearean plays. And the Coriolanus one, we noted, was the Shakespeare drew very heavily from Plutarch's life about Coriolanus, and in fact almost quoting verbatim from the speech of Coriolanus' mother at the moment of his downfall. An interesting factoid, it seems to me, is that Julius Caesar's life is from about 100 B.C. to 44 B.C. Does anybody know the day he died?
March 15.
Everybody knows the day he died. It's in March. And it's interesting that Plutarch was born in 45 AD, so we're not talking about a great deal of separation in time between the end of the life of Caesar and the birth of Plutarch, a period of 90, 91 years. So this person, Julius Caesar, is almost a contemporary of Plutarch. Gaius Julius Caesar was born to an aristocratic family. One of the facts which secondary sources tell us about Plutarch's life as it comes down to us is that it probably is incomplete, because those of you who may have read it will notice that we start out talking about an episode of Julius Caesar's life when he's married and he's having struggles with the Emperor Sulla. Not the Emperor Sulla, but the political leader Sulla. So entirely omitted from Plutarch's life is the young life of young Julius Caesar. In any event, we're not talking about his life in general, but as related by Plutarch, and so I will tell you that in the first instance here, we are concerned with why Caesar was not liked well by Sulla. And the reason for that is that Sulla was married to a woman whose husband was Marius the Elder, and Marius was one of the great competitors in politics with Sulla. And Sulla wanted Caesar to put away his wife, that is, divorce her, so that he could get her dowry. Because Caesar was not liked by Sulla, Caesar decided to escape. And Plutarch tells us that he escaped to the Sabines, and we will remember, because we studied in another life, the Sabines were a people that were very near physically to Rome. Maybe you remember the famous picture of the Sabine women, which is a picture in which the the mothers and their daughters, the Sabines were stolen by the Romans in order to so that they could have wives and such. And anyway, there was a great battle of the Romans against the Sabines to get the women back. And the famous painting is the Sabine women interposing themselves between their now Roman husbands and their former brothers and dads, who were the Sabines, and trying to stop this civil war and bring the Sabine people and the Romans together. And there was a success there. Anyway, back to our story, which is that the first escape that Caesar made was to the Sabines. That didn't work out very well, and so Caesar decided to go further. And so what he did was he went to a place called Bithynia, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is basically northern Turkey. And it consists of the Bosphorus Straits, the Dardanelles, and the coast along the Black Sea. And so there's a lot of Greek colonies up there, and Caesar escaped to there. He didn't stay very long, and he decided to return, and he was captured by pirates. Now, Caesar was a very prideful person, and when he heard that they were asking for 20 talents ransom, and you'll remember what a talent is, it's about what a warship is. A talent is a huge amount of money. It's equivalent to the cost of a warship. Caesar was insulted by the amount that they were asking for, and he said, "Look, I will pay you 50 to release me." And so while he was waiting for his money from Miletus, which is another Greek colony, but this one is down the coast on the seaside, down south of Troy, and it's also a place famous for philosophy. But he was waiting for his money from there, and he was in the custody of the barbarians. And he was very haughty with them, and he said, "Look, you know, when I get loose, I'm going to come back and I'm going to punish you all for having done this." And at night when he would go to bed, he'd yell at the pirates and say, "Look, I'm trying to sleep, stop talking." And so he was quite a haughty prisoner. Well, at some point they did bring the 50 talents, and he was released. And the first thing that he did was he collected an army and some ships, and he went to the pirates. He captured them and he crucified them all. So he kept his word, and he got his money back as well. So now Sulla is waning in power in Rome, and he ultimately dies, as do we all. And so Caesar goes back and he becomes a lawyer, essentially a lawyer in Rome, and he is spends his time. They say he impeached Dolabel, which means that Dolabel was the manager of a province, and the people there complained against him and said, "You have mismanaged this province. You have stolen money as the quaestor." And so Caesar would with the prosecute these people, and he apparently did a good job and ingratiated himself to the people because of his good job as a prosecutor of people who perform badly. Now, a lot of the Plutarch's history of Caesar in this first part, well, the entire thing really, is talking about the way in which Caesar the politician made himself popular with the people, starting with the story about him being a good lawyer, prosecuting dirty politicians. We see that happen in New York, don't we, when the Attorney General of New York prosecutes a bank for, you know, excessive interest or whatever they do to impress the populace with their good things. But among the things that the political events that Plutarch tells us about Caesar's life is, for example, the first one is when his aunt Julia died, that is, Caesar's father had a sister who was named Julia, and Julia, of course, is the feminine form of Julius. He gave a eulogy, that is, Julius Caesar gave a eulogy for his aunt, and this went well with the populace. He also made reference to Marius, who was this political enemy of Sulla, who had been out of favor for a while, and he tries to bring him back and refers to him during his eulogy. Furthermore, Julius Caesar gave a eulogy for his own wife when his own wife died. And so Plutarch tells us that the people thought that this was so sweet, you know, that he's a man of feeling, he's loving and he's kind. And of course there's a certain cynicism what Plutarch is telling us, suggesting that he's doing all of this for political expediency. Well, as a result of his political maneuverings, he gets appointed to the quaestor of Spain. And what the quaestor is sort of like a treasurer. He's a person who he manages financial assets, he does audits, and he does those type of things. And so he's sent off to Spain in that capacity. While in that capacity, he marries his third wife. We just had the death of the second wife. I couldn't find out who the first one was. But he marries a third wife whose name is Pompeia, which is of some interest shortly. Among the other political jobs that Julius Caesar had was that he became the curator of the Appian Way. Now, I've heard of the Appian Way, but I didn't know what it was, so having had the reference here, I looked it up. And the Appian Way is a famous road that goes basically from Rome to Mount Vesuvius. It's along the west coast of Italy. And during his lifetime, in 71 B.C., the Appian Way was the road on which 6,000 crosses were erected to crucify the followers of Spartacus. So the Appian Way is the famous scene that we see in the movie Spartacus, where they're crucifying the slaves. I suppose as curator of the Appian Way, he had to clean up that mess at some point. He also was he had a deanship, which is a board of magistrates which governed various public buildings and things like that, very much like a curator, although it's part of a group of people. In that capacity, he brought more image of Marius back to the city of Rome to the pleasure of the people, especially the people who liked Marius. He also, during this period, was elected a high priest, the Pontifex Maximus. So he's a very busy man in terms of politics. He had lots and lots of political activities. Now, during the course of his during this period of time, he had a great family incident, which we've actually heard about in another context. He was married, as I just mentioned, to Pompeia, and Pompeia was the object of the affection of a guy named Publius Clodius. And this was apparently a young aristocrat, and he wanted access to Caesar's wife. And apparently she was ready, willing, and able. She was not, a modest wife, and so she was willing to accept the advances of Publius Clodius. And so on the occasion of a religious celebration, which is only for women to perform, all of the men had been put out of Caesar's house. And of course, his wife Pompeia is in there, and Clodius, who is a young man and doesn't have a beard, dresses up as a lady and tries to infiltrate the house, and he's let in by a maid and this type of thing. And so he's sort of wandering about the house trying to find Pompeia so that he can engage with her. And he's noticed by a lute girl, just a young woman, who then says to him, you know, will you play with me? That's actually the way Plutarch puts it. And then he responds to that, and the lute girl recognizes that this is the voice of a man. And so she sends out a general alarm, and Aurelia, Caesar's mother, you know, finds him and gets him ejected from the house. Of course, this is a great scandal across all of Rome. And Caesar's embarrassed, and so he divorces his wife, Pompeia. Claudius, though, was acquitted of attempted adultery, I suppose, might have been the charge, but he was acquitted, which is interesting enough. Caesar was called to be a witness at the trial of Claudius, and he said, well, gee, I don't know anything about it. And the prosecutor said to him harshly, he said, well, why then did you divorce your wife, Pompeia? And he said, well, I don't know anything about it, but the wife of Caesar should be beyond suspicion. And there's suspicion. So it's of interest to wonder why he didn't put evidence against Claudius. During this period of time, I mentioned that he was the quaestor in Spain. Now he becomes the praetor of Spain, which is not the financial role. This is a more of a leadership role. He's sort of the boss of Spain. And while he is over there, he does engage in some battles and some wars. And on one occasion, he's found to be reading a history of Alexander. And he laments the fact that at his age, the same that Alexander had already conquered the known world. And then, so he's sad because he hasn't done much, even though he's in his particular position. He does things to make people like him in Spain. And so he comes up with a plan to mitigate debts and things like that, cancels debts, and so he is a very popular praetor of Spain. And he comes back to Rome and he wants to get a tribute, which is a big celebration on behalf of a leader who has done a good job. But he also wants to run as consul. And there's some conflict between you have to be present to run for consul, but you cannot be present with your army to have a triumph. And so there's sort of there's a conflict there. So he decided not to do the triumph, but to become the consul. And he is elected the consul. Now we will remember from our study of previous Roman leaders that there were two consuls, and that they were like the two bosses of the entire country. And they had two in order so they could check one another's authority. And they generally had two separate domains, which they were interested in, or they divided their authority so there wasn't any direct conflict. Obviously, he's continuing with his political maneuverings, and among the political maneuverings is a tale which Plutarch relates to us. Now, Caesar had a daughter whose name was Julia, named after him, obviously. And that Julia was engaged to somebody named Servilius. Caesar had the idea, though, that it would be more politically advantageous for him to engage Julia to Pompey, who was a major political rival, and he wanted to build bridges to Pompey. And so he did engage Julia to Pompey, which was unfortunate because and then he solved the problem of Servilius by engaging him to another person, the son of Sulla, and that person was also engaged to somebody else. So the point is that he is messing up a lot of romantic relationships, his own daughters and her engaged husbands, in order to accommodate his own political needs by having a relationship with Pompey. So I mentioned that he became the consul. His assignment as consul, the area of his responsibility, was decided that he would have Gaul, and he would have Illyricum. Now Gaul, we sort of know what that is. I mean, until I did this research, I didn't know that it was something else besides France. And it's interesting because the immediately northern part of Italy is called Cisalpine Gaul. And it's really just the top of Italy below the Alps. And that's part of Gaul. It's a big part of Gaul. And so that's what he's got, but he's also got France and all up in that area. So that's his assignment. And then the other area that I mentioned was Illyricum. And that's basically west of Italy across the Adriatic Sea. It's probably Croatia now or something like that. So that's his area of responsibility, and he takes over that area. The Gallic campaigns, the campaigns in Gaul, are probably the most important part of Caesar's life. And you may know that my son is taking Latin, and one of the assignments I gave to him is that I want you to be reading Caesar's commentaries by the time you're finished with your Latin. And it turns out that Caesar's commentaries have always been a part of the Latin curriculum because they're very clear, very well written, very simple Latin. And Caesar's commentaries are a collection of 8 essays, 7 of which are written by Caesar, one of which is by his general, the last one is written by his general. But they are the content of his Gallic war years. Plutarch has a couple of anecdotes which he uses to illustrate the relationship that Caesar had with his men. And what he's saying is that Caesar was such a great leader that he inspired his men to greatness. And he tells a story about Asilas, who at a fight in Marseille had his hand cut off, and still, even though his hand was cut off, he clung with his other hand to the shield, and he dashed the faces of the foes and personally took over the ship. Obviously heroic and spectacular deed. He tells another story of a man named Cassius who had his eye struck out with an arrow, had a javelin in his arm and a javelin in his thigh, and still he continued to fight, and he said, okay, I surrender. And then just as the people came up to accept his surrender, he struck back, cut their arms off with swords, and then ultimately was saved by his comrades. So Plutarch gives these heroic stories by which he communicates the power that Caesar had over his men to influence them. He also talks about some characteristics of Caesar other than telling what other people did. He said that he was very good with the awards, giving awards and honors, and that he seldom gave to himself more than he gave to his men. He was very generous with his men. He was very willing to jump into the battle with his men and didn't avoid that at all. He apparently had epilepsy, and Plutarch tells us that in order to overcome that, he would always have a simple diet, he'll always sleep in the open air, he would go on long, long journeys, and when he would go to sleep, he would ride in a cart on the road, so he was always busy. Plutarch tells us that while he was on these campaigns, that he was always dictating to a slave. So I guess this is how I wrote the commentaries. He was riding down the road on the way to Paris or whatever, and he's dictating to his slave the story of his travels. Plutarch tells us that his horsemanship was magnificent, and that it was easy for him, since he was a boy, to ride on the back of the horse at full gallop with his hands behind his back. And I've actually seen, not that in the case of Caesar, but I've seen that in movies depicted of the great horseman who has such skill that he can ride a horse without his hands. Plutarch tells us that he was a great letter writer, that most of his communication with his friends was by a letter, and he says that he invented that. I find that hard to believe, but that's what Plutarch says. He mentions an episode in which sort of a crude host was serving asparagus, and the asparagus was dressed up with myrrh rather than olive oil, and that he ate it without objection, and when his friends objected, he said to his friends that they were of low birth to object to the food of a host in this fashion. And the final episode that Plutarch relates is that on one occasion they found themselves out on a field, and there was a house that they were going to occupy for the night. And it turns out that it was a very small house, so I only had room for one person. And they gave it to one of their sick comrades. And Caesar said that while honors must be yielded to the strongest, the necessities go to the weakest. So he was a big with his friends. Now, a large part of what we hear, what we read here in Plutarch, are the Gallic campaigns. And he was in Gaul for about 9 years. And as I mentioned, there, he wrote 7 commentaries, with a final one written, number 8, written by his general. Now, what it tells us here is that in the wintertime, when they weren't fighting, Caesar would not come all the way back to Rome, or not always come all the way back to Rome, but he'd come back to the Po River. One of the great pleasures I have in doing this work is learning something about geography. So I looked up where the Po River is. Does anybody have any idea where the Po is? It's basically the river that goes across northern Italy. You know, Milan is part of the river system of Milan. But the entire northern Italy, below the Alps, is a great plain. It's the great basin of the Po River. And this is also Cisalpine Gaul. And it's not totally clear to me from the reading of the text, but it looks to me like when they go to Gaul, they go to the far western portion of Italy, up the coast there, and then across the top of that open plain. Apparently there's some mountains which separate Rome from, immediately separate Rome from the land, and so it's easier to go that roundabout way. So he would come back there and winter himself there. Among the great activities that he performed while he was on campaign in Gaul were he went to Britain, he crossed over into Britain. He said that, it wasn't worth the trouble, saying, quote, "There's nothing worth taking from men who live in poverty and wretchedness." So he got out of Britain before too long because there wasn't much up there. There was lots of rebellions and stuff like that. He'd defeat a place in Gaul, and then the next season they'd be backfighting, and so he was always going back to fight. But on one occasion he decided he wanted to cross the Rhine River, which is the river that separates France-Gaul from Germany. And apparently it's a very difficult river to cross, but in 10 days he built a spectacular bridge, which according to Plutarch was a sight beyond all credence. And so he went over there into Germany with his army, but nobody would engage him. All of them put their people and their belongings deep in the dark forest. And one of the images I have of Germany is the Black Forest. You know, called the Black Forest. You know, an enormously deep and dark forest. And apparently they all sort of retreated back into there. And what Caesar did was they just burned everything that was not forest, but, you know, all the lands and the buildings about there. But he didn't have any engagements, and so he went back. Meanwhile, back in Rome, Julia died. Julia was married to Pompey. She died in childbirth, and of course this is a problem when your only connection with your political foe is your daughter, who is his wife. Is that right? So Pompey was sort of like his son-in-law, although they were the ultimate in political enemies, which connection was severed by virtue of the death of Julia. So there's this great civil war between Pompey, or there's this problem between Pompey and Caesar, and one of the and the episode which sort of brings it to the ultimate head and the ultimate civil war is the famous crossing of the Rubicon. Everybody knows that story. The interesting where the Rubicon is. The Rubicon, we're talking about the Po River, which is basically an east-west river across the plain, which is northern Italy. The Rubicon is further down the west coast of Italy, but it apparently marks the actual barrier, the Rubicon does, between Cisalpine Gaul and the Roman territory. And it was a death penalty offense for a general to come back into the country with his army. And it was also a death penalty for the army if they came back with him. And so the decision across the Rubicon as a part of the Civil War was obviously a big deal. He was violating a death penalty law, as were all his men. So in any event, he came and initiated the Great Civil War. He actually engaged in several battles with Pompey, and he defeated Pompey, and Pompey fled to Brundisium, which is the heel of Italy. And Pompey jumped over into Greece and got out of his reach. But because Pompey had retreated and abandoned Italy, Caesar became the master of Italy. He was the undisputed master of Italy, He was named the dictator many times, but in this particular occasion only for about 11 days, just because it's not a good thing to be the dictator in the view of the Roman people. So, he decides he's not going to pursue Pompey immediately, and so what he decides to do is go back into Spain, which we'll remember that he'd already been there, to defeat some of Pompey's the people on Pompey's side. He doesn't want to have people in his rear, was his theory, you know, the rear being Spain, the head being Greece, when he's going after Pompey. One of the images that I came away with after reading all this material was this picture of the travels of the man. You know, I mentioned first that he went to Spain as a quaestor, and then he came back, and then he gets Gaul, and he's all over Gaul, you know, northern Italy, France, Britain, Germany, and then he comes back to France, and now he's fighting in France, then he goes back to Spain, and there's this huge travels of this man's life. But anyway, so now we find him again back in Italy after defeating the people of Pompey in the rear, and he goes down to Brundisium, which again is the heel of Italy, and the reason it's a popular spot is because it's not far across the water to get to Greece. And that's what that's all about. And so he crosses over into Greece, and after various activities, there's an occasion to finally engage with Pompey. And the place to engage is the plain of Pharsalus, which is north of Athens, significantly north of Athens. And it's a relatively large area of Greece when you look on the map, and a great place for a battle. Plutarch tells us that the battle was unbalanced, that Pompey had a cavalry of 7,000 and Caesar had a cavalry of 1,000. Pompey's army was 45,000 infantry and Caesar's was 22 infantry. Who knows if that's true or not. I suppose if you're writing your own story, you know, you might exaggerate the differences in men. And obviously Caesar won this battle, and the method by which Plutarch tells us he won this battle was that the soldiers of Pompey, of course they talk about the positions of the various wings and the battle forces and all that in the text, but one of the thing that struck me was Plutarch tells us that Caesar told his men that when you're attacking the soldiers of Pompey, hit them in the face and the eyes, because these are all young guys and they don't want to have scars, they don't want to have their eyeballs put out, uglify them. You know, when you're going into battle, don't just stab him in his chest, because that's not a wound that you would be ashamed about. Make him look ugly. And so Plutarch tells us that by this technique, Caesar's men terrified the Pompey's men and they routed him. Which, you know, is kind of an interesting technique. So Pompey loses and he escapes. He runs away in a very ignominious retreat. I'm just going to read the ignominious retreat here for a few seconds. When Pompey on their wing saw his horsemen scattered in flight, he was no longer the same man, nor remembered that he was Pompey the Great, but more like one whom heaven has robbed of his wits than anything else. He went off without a word to his tent, sat down there, and waited what was to come until his forces were all routed and the enemy were assailing his ramparts and fighting with their defenders. Then he came to his senses, as it were, and with this one ejaculation, as they say, "What, even to my quarters?" he took off his fighting and general's dress, put on one suitable for a fugitive, and stole away. What his subsequent fortunes were and how he delivered himself into the hands of the Egyptians and was murdered, I shall tell in his life. That's pretty ignominious defeat, you know, when he goes scurrying off into the wilderness. So, anyway, Caesar is going to follow him. Caesar's in the middle of Greece now. I don't know the details of his travel, but I wouldn't be surprised if he retraced Darius's attack on Greece, which is to go up over the Aegean Sea and then across the Bosphorus Straits and then across Turkey and then down into Syria. But that's not said here. I mean, I guess they could sail over there to Syria too, but so it's some method they go and they find themselves in Europe. They find themselves in Egypt, where, of course, we have Cleopatra. And Cleopatra and her brother Ptolemy are on the outs, and Cleopatra is actually out in the country. And There is a eunuch by the name of Polyphenus who is in control, basically, who's in, of great favor and somehow the big boss. Oh, I forgot to mention that the head of Pompeii is brought to Caesar by Theodotus. They don't explain how that happened, but somebody murdered Pompey while he was on his retreat, and they, in hopes of gaining favor from Caesar, delivered his head to him, and Caesar turned away, shed tears, did receive the rings of Pompey. So Pompey's ending was not good. So Caesar finds himself in the middle of Egypt in the conflict between Ptolemy and his sister Cleopatra. His greatest interest is, of course, according to Plutarch. Plutarch says, as for the war in Egypt, some say it was not necessary, but due to Caesar's passion for Cleopatra. It's all about the woman in this case. Cleopatra is summoned back from the countryside by Caesar, and she is delivered in the famous carpet. You know, we've all seen that scene in the movie Cleopatra where, you know, she's rolled up in the carpet, and they unroll the carpet, and there's the beautiful Cleopatra. And in that case was, who was it? Elizabeth Taylor. So he has children by her. He ends up fighting with the eunuch, and there's a sort of a civil war in Egypt. And Caesar, because he doesn't have a whole lot of resources, resorts to fire in Alexandria. And Plutarch tells us that it's Caesar who burned up the Alexandria library, which I didn't know that, but that's sad. That certainly was a great loss. And during that battle, the king got lost. Ptolemy was lost, and so Caesar is left on the crown. Cleopatra is left in control of Egypt, and Caesar returns to Rome. He's proclaimed the dictator. The civil war continues, and at some point he becomes the actual and total dictator for life. And of course, this is a problem for the senators. This is a problem for some of the people. And during this period, he also went back to Spain one more time. And finally, we find ourselves at the moment when he is facing his final challenge, which is the challenge of the senators who want to kill him. Of course, there's many warnings that are recounted by Plutarch of the inauspicious pictures of birds. His own wife has a dream and tells her that it's not a good idea to return to go to the Senate on the Ides of March. But he nevertheless decides that he's going to the Senate on the Ides of March. And I wanted to read that very unpleasant but brief story to you where he is executed. The death of Caesar. So the affair began, and those who were not privy to the plot were filled with consternation and horror at what was going on. They dared not fly, nor go to Caesar's help, nay, nor even utter a word. But those who had prepared themselves for the murder bared each of them his dagger, and Caesar, hemmed in on all sides, whichever way he turned, confronting blows of weapons aimed at his face and eyes, driven hither and thither like a wild beast, was entangled in the hands of all. For all had to take part in the sacrifice and tasted the slaughter. Therefore Brutus also gave him one blow in the groin. And it's said by some writers that although Caesar defended himself against the rest and darted this way and that and cried aloud, when he saw that Brutus had drawn his dagger, he pulled his toga down over his head and sank, either by chance or because pushed there by his murderers, against the pedestal on which the statue of Pompey stood. And the pedestal was drenched with his blood, so that one might have thought that Pompey himself was presiding over his vengeance upon his enemy, who now lay prostrate at his feet, quivering from a multitude of wounds. For it is said that he received 23, and many of the conspirators were wounded by one another as they struggled to plant all those blows in one body. Thus Caesar died. The people didn't know what to think about this, but when Caesar's will was opened, it was apparent that Caesar had been very generous to the people. He had given a massive gift to all the people upon his death. And when his body was carried into the forum, all the people saw how brutally it had been disfigured. They went crazy, and they actually burned his body on the spot. And obviously great difficulties followed, which is another story. I wanted to mention a couple of the things which Caesar had in mind when he became the ultimate leader. in terms of his future ambitions. He wanted to dig a canal across the Isthmus of Corinth, and this is that very small, narrow body of land which separates the big part where Athens is from the big part where Sparta is. It's a little small there, small part there. He wanted to divert the Tiber River to make it more accessible, to make Rome more accessible to ships. I mean, these are big plans. He wanted to convert a marsh near Rome into farmland. And of course, he made adjustments to the calendar. So he had big plans, but unfortunately he was lost. All right, thus ended Caesar's life. If anybody has any comments, I'd love to receive them. If not, we will adjourn at this moment, and we will resume in 19 minutes for the big show. Thank you all.